listening to the However Improbable podcast, a Sherlock Holmes book club that narrates and discusses Arthur Conan Doyle's classic tales. We're reading them in the order they occurred in the lives of the great detective and his good doctor.
Holmes himself famously said that there's nothing new under the sun, but we're willing to give him a run for his money. Sort of literally, in the case of this story that we're going to talk about. I'm Sarah Cole.
And I'm Marissa Mercurio. It's a lovely spring day in 1888, and Sherlock Holmes is bored.
Wah, wah.
Thus begins The Adventure of the Yellow Face, the third tale in the short story collection The Memoirs of Sherlock Holmes. Holmes's boredom turns into chagrin by the end of the day, in this tale of jealous husbands, creepy maids, and the perils of making assumptions.
The Adventure of the Yellow Face was published in The Strand in 1893, one of the more sentimental stories in the canon. It's remarkable because Holmes's deductive powers fail him, and Watson's romantic sentimentality wins the day. Our chronology has the story taking place on April 7th, 1888.
It begins with Holmes and Watson out on one of their iconic strolls. They return to Baker Street to discover a client has come calling and they missed him, but he left his pipe behind. Mr. Grant Munro soon returns to tell his unusual tale. He's suspicious that his wife, Effie, is hiding something from him because she keeps sneaking out of their house to check in on the inhabitants of a nearby cottage. A sinister servant and a face in one window wearing a strange yellow mask.
Sinister. Holmes and Watson follow Munro to Norbury to investigate. Holmes's theory, Effie's first husband, a supposedly deceased American boxer, isn't actually dead and he's blackmailing her to keep the secret. They break into the cottage to discover Effie and a little black girl, her daughter. Effie's first husband was not just a boxer, he was a black boxer in Georgia, and she kept their child a secret out of fear that her new husband would throw her out for having a mixed-race child. Proving her wrong, Munro embraces the little girl, whose name is Lucy. On their way home, Holmes admits his miscalculation and tells Watson to hold this case over him if he ever becomes overconfident in the future.
Before we start making sense of this unique little story, here's what our narrator Alex thought of it.
It's been 129 years since The Adventure of the Yellow Face was published in the Strand magazine, but it seems to me that it's a story that could just as easily have been written last week. The sad truth of the matter is that over a century later, the themes that have aged out of the story are the prevalence of pipe tobacco and gas lanterns, while the ever-present fear of racial intolerance still remains. It should be unfathomable to us in a modern civil society that anyone should fear their own neighbors or the reactions of their family to someone that they dearly love, and yet any of us who are paying attention is painfully aware that that is not the case. I hope strongly that there comes a day when the concept is so bizarre to some new reader as the concepts of lead paint and asbestos insulation are to us now. But in order to achieve that, there is a lot of work to be done as we recognize our own privileges and call out our own bad behaviors. When I first read this story several years ago, it stuck out to me because Holmes, established through the rest of the stories as almost superhuman in his infallibility, uses his methods to assemble a perfectly reasonable explanation that also turns out to be completely wrong. A criticism that has often been levied against the Holmes adventures by fans and detractors alike. And though Holmes is back to being in fighting form for the next story, the message resonates with me even more today. It's easy for me, and as I look around the blast crater that Facebook and Twitter have become in the last couple of years, I don't believe I'm the only one by far. To fall into the pattern of believing I'm the only sane person in the room, and that I must have everything figured out, must be acting perfectly rationally, and that if anyone else doesn't see things the way I see them, well, then that must mean there's something wrong with them. Because the other option, that someone might have a different view, or, God forbid, that I might simply be wrong, is unimaginable. I think we could all do with someone to kindly whisper Norbury in our ear from time to time. And perhaps the world would be a better place for it.
So, Sarah, what did you think of this story?
It's kind of out of character. I don't know how well it fits into the Holmes canon, but I like it as a story. I think it's doing some interesting things, even if it's like not really a mystery, and I don't really know why Doyle wrote it at all. It sort of is like lodged in my brain as like one of Doyle's stories about race. There are a couple where this mm-hmm. comes up, and along with its sort of questionable name, I had assumed that it was going to be something really offensive. And I don't think it's quite that. So that was a nice surprise.
Yes, I was dreading this episode because I have not read this story since high school. And all I could remember was the name of it and the fact that it was about race. And I was like, oh no. Oh no. And especially considering Conan Doyle's track history thus far.
Yeah.
I had no reason to expect anything good from him. And I don't think the story is perfect on those grounds. And we'll get into that. But it is far less offensive than I was expecting, and actually has a nice sentiment at its heart.
There's something, I think, about the name that sort of sets you up to think it's going to be one thing, and then it goes down a different direction. So maybe that was sort of intentional on his part.
The other thing, like you commented on, it not really being a mystery was definitely something that I took away from this story as well, that Holmes doesn't really do any crime solving.
No.
In this little, very quite short story as well. This is one of the shorter ones I think we've read thus far.
Yeah, it's mostly dialogue.
Yeah, and it's really just Holmes breaking into someone's house and demanding that they explain the situation. So,
yeah,
no mystery solving required.
Not at all. He erroneously guesses what's going on, he's wrong, and he breaks and enters. All in a day's work.
Wonderful.
For Sherlock Holmes.
It's interesting, too, that I really did feel conflicted with Holmes's work in this story,
mm-hmm.
where I was like, is he really, I'm not against him in this story because he doesn't do enough to be against particularly, but I wasn't really on his side either.
Yeah.
Because he does break and enter into this woman's abode or side abode. And I was like, do you really need to be doing this? I don't think so. It seems like something maybe the husband and the wife could have taken care of on their own.
Everyone, I think, behaves a little bit ridiculously, except for Watson, who's kind of just following along in this story. Like, I don't think anyone is really making the best choices, either Holmes or husband or wife.
I agree. In this case. Should we start with Watson and why this story at all?
I think that's an interesting question because it, again, is not really a mystery. Holmes doesn't really do any incredible deductive work mm-hmm. other than his little magic trick with the pipe at the beginning. So, like, why is this one that Watson would choose to write down and publish?
Well, to his credit, Watson does do a little explanation of why he has chosen to tell this story, correct? So what Watson writes at the beginning of the story is that where he failed, Holmes failed, it happened too often that no one else succeeded, and that the tale was left forever without a conclusion. Now and again, however, it chanced that even when he erred, the truth was still discovered. So this is a unique case in the way that Watson is framing it, that it is a case in which Holmes fails, which, again, is something that we have seen before. But it's not so much that Holmes rectifies his failures, but that they just come out anyway, and things get solved on their own.
Right. And we've had Watson make this sort of comment before, that he often won't publish stories where Holmes gets things wrong because Holmes is so brilliant that if he gets these things wrong, no one else is going to get it right, and they go unsolved.
Right.
We've seen that theme come up a couple times. But he does mention specifically, he mentions The Adventure of the Second Stain and the Musgrave Ritual, right? As examples of stories that Holmes was not quite at his best, or things didn't quite add up for him.
Mm-hmm.
So we've seen this in the stories that we've covered. We've seen this more often than I think I expected to.
Yes, I agree, because I think Watson, every time he says that, oh, Holmes never fails, or very rarely fails, lately I've been thinking, well, you've given us quite a few examples of his failure. Yeah. Obviously, Five Orange Pips is the most significant example. A Scandal in Bohemia, I think, is another example. So, in terms of the balance here, maybe it is disproportionate in the stories that we've had thus far, but we have certainly had plenty of examples where Holmes does not do his best.
And I think he kind of phones it in here.
Oh, he's absolutely. He's not on top of it today.
Yeah, I wonder if Watson publishing this is sort of, like, he's humanizing Holmes in a way.
Mm-hmm.
To say, like, look, he can make incorrect assumptions about human behavior, too, just like the rest of us.
Yeah, that's an interesting theory. I think also part of it is just getting across the agenda, for a lack of better word, of the story, the message, I suppose.
True.
Because, as we will discover later on, Watson is very much touched by what happens in the course of this mystery. And I think it might just be something that he wanted to write about, regardless of how it paints Holmes.
Yeah, that's a good point, too. Clearly, it probably made him feel pretty good to be involved in this, even though, again,
he does absolutely nothing.
Do anything at all. But, you know,
he's there and he took notes.
You gotta pay those consulting detective bills somehow. First off, before we get into the mystery itself and the couple and everything, there are a couple, I think, really interesting little tidbits about Holmes that Watson tells us in this story that I think are worth discussing. First, for some reason, right off the top, Watson goes into this whole diatribe about Holmes's athleticism.
Ew. Which,
fine, Watson. I don't know what's going on there.
Tell us more.
Right. He's very complimentary of his physique and his energy, but he also specifically says that Holmes is one of the finest boxers that he's ever seen. So we see this pop up in adaptations sometimes, notably Guy Ritchie.
Yes.
And I think this Elementary. Is the source of it. Yeah.
Being true. In Elementary as well.
I guess maybe it's sort of mentioned in passing in A Study in Scarlet, but...
I can't recall. I know it's mentioned in The Sign of Four.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't recall if it's in A Study in Scarlet or not. But this is definitely, you're right, the most explicit example of Holmes being a boxer.
I also think there's something, you know, there's a theory about Watson being a gambler. Watson has perhaps watched a lot
forking
of boxing
over
matches.
A little bit
so.
Of money betting on Holmes.
I think he may know what he's talking about here.
Right. This is only the only time when Holmes will unlock his checkbook from the drawer and allow Watson to make a bet. It's when he bets
exactly.
on Holmes.
When he's pretty sure that he's going to win.
Right.
Anyway. But then Watson goes on to say that Holmes considers aimless bodily exertion a waste of energy.
Mm-hmm. He explains that Holmes will work himself to death, basically putting all of his immense energy into a case and never letting up and also not eating well, but then otherwise can't be bothered to exercise when he's not on a case.
Which, you know, I wish that could be me.
Yeah, me too.
Sort of jealous of his metabolism.
Yeah.
But that's neither here nor there.
There's another thing we learn about Holmes's characters and his his character and his habits.
Yeah, his drug use specifically. People interpret Holmes's use of cocaine in a lot of different ways, and Watson sort of addresses it quite specifically about what it's doing for him here. So this is what he writes. He says, "Save for the occasional use of cocaine, he had no vices, and he only turned to the drug as a protest against the monotony of existence when cases were scanty and the papers uninteresting."
This tracks with what we know about Holmes, in that he takes drugs when he's bored to use it as a replacement for the high of being on a case. I think you're right in saying that adaptations make different use of Holmes's cocaine use, in some that they are small little habit, in many that they are this bigger issue. It would be interesting to me to think about, okay, we're in 1888 right now, does this change within the canon,
yeah.
right? Do we see this evolve?
Right.
Because a lot of times I think it's framed in adaptations as something that, or even in like popular thought about Sherlock Holmes, that it starts out as a little habit and then evolves into a larger issue over the course of his life. So I don't know if that's supported by the canon or not, because again, this is obviously the first time that we've read the canon in this manner, chronologically.
Let's kind of, like, put a pin in that
yes.
to come back around in it as it comes up. And I think you're right that people pull a lot of different threads on this topic, sometimes sort of offensively and sometimes quite effectively in the case of Elementary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think they do something really impactful and touching with that story. But it does feel like, based on this, maybe, like, a little bit of an exaggeration. But who knows where
right.
things are going to go.
Embellished.
So.
And Granada Holmes, too, I think, does it very delicately.
Definitely.
And then the other thing that we wanted to talk about in terms of where they are in the Yellow Face is Holmes and Watson's friendship status.
Yeah.
They go out for a walk together at the beginning of the story that lasts for 2 hours.
I always love when they take a
stroll. So what Watson writes about this is that, quote, "For 2 hours we rambled about together in silence for the most part, as befits two men who know each other intimately." It's very nice.
It is very nice.
Yeah. And especially considering where we were in the Valley of Fear, which wasn't rocky per se, but they were a little bit bickering roommates.
Yeah.
To some
maybe
degree.
A little more tense with each other.
Yes. And they are a little bit easier with each other here.
Yeah.
Although I also do really like this moment that after Holmes and Watson return to Baker Street and they find out that Monroe has come and left while they were out for a walk, Holmes looks at Watson, quote, reproachfully, because they've missed a client because they were out on a walk. And Holmes says, "It's very annoying, though, Watson. I was badly in need of a case." Which I don't think is, you know, he's not actually mad at Watson, but it's quite funny.
Yeah, and but then they spend some time
right.
observing a pipe together.
Yeah, it's a little bit more like a ribbing than it is anything.
I think so. Yeah, a little affectionate teasing. Yeah, so I feel like they've patched things up a little bit. Weird tension was going on with them in the Valley of Fear. I think it's eased up.
Yes.
I think the Valley of Fear was in, like, January 1888, and now we're in April, so some time has gone by.
Correct. Yeah, that's a good point. We have had several months' progression over the course of a single story. Now,
there's no graceful way to segue.
There is no graceful way to segue into this topic, but is obviously the most significant aspect of the story, which is Conan Doyle's depiction of race and racism.
Specifically, anti-black racism, which we have not really seen other than sort of in the periphery of the Five Orange Pips.
Right.
Has not really come up in the Doyle stories, and doesn't really seem to exist in the universe of Sherlock Holmes until now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We've talked extensively how Conan Doyle's stories are imbued with racism, particular mm-hmm. racism against those colonized nations and nations in which Britain has a stake in imperialism. But you're right in saying that we haven't seen a lot of attention to specifically black people in specifically anti-black racism in
right.
the U.S. versus U.K. relations.
I think this is the first story where we have some black characters that are named.
Yeah,
or like
right.
part of the plot.
That's a very good point.
If they exist at any other point in the canon so far, they're like in the periphery.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is dead and the other one is a child who doesn't speak.
She's got...
So I can't say this is, like,
does she not have any lines? There's one part where she laughs because...
She laughs. And it's a very impactful moment. But... And it's hard to tell how old she is. She could... I think she's quite
from the
young.
Illustrations, she looks to be, like, maybe, I don't know, anywhere between 6 and 8, probably.
Okay.
But, again, those are illustrations and don't have a yeah. ton of impact on the actual text itself.
The Yellow Face, I think, is it's notable because it's really specifically addressing some of these topics
mm-hmm.
in a way that a lot of the other stories are treading on conversations and attitudes about racism because they're written by somebody named Sir someone
right.
in a period of time, and he had opinions about British colonialism and imperialism and all this stuff. You know, this is why I think this story stands out, even though, again, not a ton happens. And it's not very long. It's because he's addressing this quite directly. And he actually has something to say about it for once.
Let's just say a very intentional approach to this story.
Yes.
With a solid, concise message that he is bringing to the table.
The Wikipedia page for
yes,
the Yellow Face.
Please.
So take that with a grain of salt. But I did think this was interesting. This is why I copied and pasted this. It sounds like there have been remarks that Doyle's writing about interracial marriage is relatively liberal for the time, because in a lot of places it was illegal, not in England, but probably in America, depending on where Effie and
US.
John Hebron. I think they were in Georgia.
Yeah, so I would imagine definitely. And even if yeah. not on the books, then in general practice. Because, of
right.
course, the Loving case wasn't until, was it the 60s? Was it that late?
I think it was the 60s. Yeah. It was one of those things that's frighteningly late when you think about it.
So that's the anti-miscegenation laws that were lifted in the 1960s in the U.S.
Yeah, nationwide. Yes. Some states had rolled this out sooner. I don't think Georgia was one of them.
Highly doubt it. I do have some substantiation to Wikipedia's claims. I did a little bit of research on The Adventure of the Yellow Face. There's very little scholarship on this story. On one hand, that surprises me because Conan Doyle is so direct about race and racism in the story, and you would think that there might be a wider breadth of analysis of Conan Doyle's relationship to race in the Conan Doyle's or in the Sherlock Holmes stories. But on the other hand, this is not a very well-known Sherlock Holmes story, and again, it's very brief. So, this is from an article called Sherlock Holmes and the Case of Race by Henry Cunningham. Okay. After the 1850s, England underwent a dramatic shift in racial attitudes. And Cunningham goes on to say that while people like Frederick Douglass had, quote, once been welcomed into the highest ranks of British society at the end of the 19th century, dominant thought considered black people, quote, incapable of being gentlemen at the fin de siècle. So by the time that Conan Doyle was writing the story and by the time that the story takes place, Victorians viewed them as, quote, on a level with white factory workers who occupied one of the lowest rungs of British society. Broadly speaking, this article posits that Conan Doyle, quote, consciously used the device of a grotesque face to make his didactic message more palatable to a largely prejudiced audience. So this does substantiate the Wikipedia's claim that Conan Doyle was taking a more liberal stance for his time period than was the dominant discourse in Victorian culture at this time. So it's interesting to think about, I think, like, what this article is explaining, that pre-1850, there may not have been such entrenched racism, which is interesting to think about because, of course, Britain didn't criminalize slavery on British borders, on British land, until the early 19th century, I believe. Of course, they still had colonies, which had a lot of enslaved people globally.
it's easy to say, look at England as, like, the geographic location and say one thing and then the rest of the world and think something else.
Correct. But I think this does track with both the United States and Europe broadly in their relationship to racism. I mean, if you think about the U.S., like, post-Reconstruction, racism ramps up because of the reaction that white people had to black people being freed, and then the economic downturns. Just in my limited experience in this realm of 19th century research, my understanding is that the last decades of the 19th century were particularly virulent in terms of racism. So, all that to say is that Conan Doyle gets maybe a couple points for being a decent person in the doing the least, doing the absolute least. You can't give him too much credit. Obviously, this is the stance one should have.
I don't even know where to go other than I'm relieved. I think that this is the only time that Doyle decides to tackle this particular topic.
I certainly do not trust him to go into this.
I don't want to know any more about his opinions on it.
No, because, like, as we have talked about extensively, Conan Doyle was in favor of imperialism, a certain kind of imperialism. He criticized other kinds of imperialism. I think we maybe talked about this in our mini case file episode on Conan Doyle. So go check that out from, like, a year ago or more. Right.
When I was reading these sections of the novel, when Effie's sort of telling her story about what happened and how she's ended up with her daughter, there are a couple moments where she's specifically talking about the deceased John Hebron. So they were worth looking at because I think they're both sometimes quite benevolent and also sort of
insidious,
also offensive at the same time.
I agree. I completely agree. So here's a couple
of these examples. So the first example, she has a locket, right? And she shows her husband and Holmes and Watson the a portrait of John Hebron in this locket. And so Watson describes him, a man strikingly handsome and intelligent looking, but bearing unmistakable signs upon his features of his African descent.
I pulled this exact same passage, and it's the butt, isn't it?
Yes.
It's the butt. Right.
No buts about it, guy.
He's handsome, and yet, yeah, so obviously
also,
that signifies...
You can't get around the fact that he's black.
Exactly.
I think that sort of summarizes maybe where we're coming at from this.
The other passage that I would like to point out is in Effie's own words, where she says of her husband, her, you know, John, that, quote, a nobler man never walked the earth. I cut myself off from my race in order to wed him, but never once while he lived did I for one instant regret it. Very nice sentiment. However, she continues,
oh, yes.
It was our misfortune that our only child took after his people rather than mine. It is often so in such matches, and little Lucy is darker far than ever her father was. So she is really, you know, framing this as, unfortunately, my daughter is black. Yeah. Surprise, surprise.
That's right? Absolutely what this says, yeah. Like, why are you surprised?
I know, right?
That's how genetics works. Yeah, and there's some of this, like, it's often so in such matches language, which is very sort of, like, implications about, you know, the infection of good white bloodlines and that sort of thing. That's where my mind goes with that sentiment.
It does sound as if she is sort of taking a gamble on the outcome of her child.
Right.
You know, where she's like, oh, it would be great if my child looked pretty white. But, you know, this is what happens when you marry a black man. So it's very, I think, insidious is the right word.
That sentence or that section starts where she uses the word noble to talk about John, which I think in what you were talking about, there is this sort of increased violent attitude towards black men in particular, probably. So I think that's sort of an intentional, like, positive compliment. Noble, not just handsome or brave or strong or whatever. You know, he's noble. But then, of course, it's followed up by this other stuff where, like, his genetics in their child is a misfortune. So,
And the text does nothing to confront that or condemn that attitude.
Not at all.
So that's really, like, where, because I remember having read this years ago and feeling that it was going to be a very racist story when I returned to it. And it's not as bad, like I said, as I was expecting, but it's certainly not without racism in its attempts to be anti-racist.
Yeah, that tracks.
Sure does.
Yeah, I think this makes me want to talk about this couple a little bit.
Okay. Are you talking about Effie and Monroe?
Effie and Grant Monroe. The one thing, this has nothing to do with their attitudes towards race or whether or not Effie, like, should even be a mother, which is really sort of how I feel. But she calls him, his name is Grant, and she calls him Jack. The whole time.
Conan Doyle!
Like, repeatedly, where I'm like, she just nicknamed him Jack?
I mean, the most I could do with that is that Jack would be a sort of Victorian catch-all for a man. Kind of like we would say the average Joe. But I don't know that you would use that as a name
for your spouse.
Correct, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that one just stuck out at me as being
certainly odd, yeah.
I don't know what to do with it. But, no, the way I feel about both of these things, where it's like, am I the asshole? I yelled at my wife for sneaking around thinking she's having an affair, but actually I've discovered that she had a secret biracial child that she's been hiding from me in a cottage and forcing to wear a yellow mask so people don't run in terror from her face. And I think the answer to that question is yes, but also she is too.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely felt that when Effie explains that she chose her new husband over her daughter, that right. was not a good look for her. I understand to some degree her fear that her new husband is going to react poorly to her child, right? Because of cultural mm-hmm. circumstances and just the general racist sentiment that was pervasive in the 19th century and, you know, continues to be. However, if that is the choice that you're being presented with where you are either going to marry a man who may be racist or right. take care of your biracial daughter and protect her and love her and actually be her mother and not lock her up in a room with some lady.
With some cranky old
then
lady.
I don't know.
Yeah, it just seems kind of obvious to me. Granted, I am not a Victorian woman, but with the privileged seat of history, I just am wondering about this lady's decisions.
Yeah, they're not great. Well, even Monroe says something about, like, I'm a better man than you expected me to be at the end.
Right, yeah. He says, I'm not a very good man, but I think I am a better one than you've given me credit for being. And that's also how I would feel if I was this guy.
Right.
A little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if I were her, obviously it seems to me that the correct approach would be, hey, I was married, my husband died, I have this daughter, would you like to meet her?
Yeah,
and then
before we get married. Perhaps.
Whatever ends up happening, if he turns out to be a racist, then you don't marry him.
Perhaps do not get married to men that you think may be racists, particularly when you have a black child.
Right, and I know the circumstances of being a woman in the 19th century and being economically dependent on men is very tricky and difficult. But I don't know that the solution is to, you know, throw a mask on your daughter and put her in a nearby house.
Because we do learn a little bit about their finances, and she's fairly well, like, they're not working class, but they're, like, middle class. Mm-hmm. They own an inn or something. But she's fairly wealthy, and then, obviously, when they get married, all of the money moves to him, so she has to ask him for money.
Right, but she asks for £100, which is a ton of money.
Which, like, I kind of understand why he thought she was having an affair.
Or something, like, something deeply
or
weird.
Or something was going on.
Yeah, I mean, I understand his curiosity. Absolutely.
I would be a little confused if my partner was like, I need several thousand dollars and I will not tell you why.
So, I think at the end of the day, the story on its surface has a good sentiment, but once you just dig a little bit deeper into the text, it starts to become a lot more distastefully Victorian.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's trying.
It's trying.
It's trying to say that it is, you know, better to look beyond our differences to take care of each other. That's, like, loosely what it's going for, but it's doing so in a very condescending way.
Yes. It's an interesting artifact, I think, in the history of race relations, because too often we say that people are a product of their times, which is an excuse for people being, you know, racist or homophobic or misogynistic or whatever the case may be. And I think it is interesting that you can use this story as an example of, look, like, there were people who knew that that was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they weren't great at it, you know? And certainly there were people who were handling these situations better than Conan Doyle does. It is a useful tool in an arsenal to sort of say, look, we can't just give everyone a excuse for being Victorians. Right.
Including Doyle
himself. Including Doyle
himself.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, the other thing I think is worth noting is Effie and John are American.
Right.
This is not a story about black British people. It's about Americans who come to England. Which we've seen a little bit of this theme before, but, like, racism happens
elsewhere.
Somewhere else. And then it maybe sort of is bleeding into these dynamics, but
that's a great point.
That's not where it's started.
So jumping off of the end of the story, the conclusion of the story, in which Monroe essentially, we assume, is going to adopt Lucy, either legally or maybe just unofficially.
Yeah, like, take her in and,
you know,
take care of her. Yeah, he's very sweet. He embraces her.
Watson has a lot to feel about this.
Yeah, Watson's in his feelings about how this plays out, which I think is kind of sweet.
It is. It's one of the I would say best parts of the story. It's Watson's reaction.
So I think the lead up to this situation, I think first we need to talk about Holmes's assumptions about what's going on with this case before we find out what's actually going on. Okay. Because I think they're funny, and I also think he really puts his foot in it.
Oh, he does, yeah.
As I have said. So he, I mean, based on this information, they're on their way. Holmes has agreed to try and get to the bottom of the situation, and he's theorizing to Watson about what's going on. And his theory is that Effie's husband, who Mr. Monroe has like sort of told the general backstory that she had was married to someone else and he died and now she's here. But the husband's not actually dead, that he was struck with some sort of disfiguring disease like leprosy. And so she fled America to get away from him and then met someone else and got married. And now he's back and he is blackmailing her. So
that is a lot of...
there's a lot.
That's a deductive leap.
Yeah. Going on in here. Because, like, if for me anyway, and I think we've seen Holmes sort of talk about this vein before, but I feel like if you're assuming that a woman's ex-husband is, like, trying to get money out of her, you think it's because he's a bad husband, right?
Yes.
But no, he's making this assumption that this man was, like, struck down with a disease and she didn't want to deal with it and left. And I don't know why.
Yeah.
That's where his mind goes.
Not looking good for Holmes.
Yeah, this is... he's on his little misogyny high horse.
He is, bit yeah.
Here, I think.
I think that's a pretty safe bet to be making.
And so he it's like a nice paragraph of text where he's spinning this theory. And he asks Watson, and Watson kind of goes like, well, it's kind of inconclusive.
Yeah, even Watson's kind of like, oh, I don't know.
Yeah, he's not going, wow, brilliant, scintillating over this theory. And then what happens is they go meet Grant Monroe, who says, yeah, there's still something going on. They haven't left the house, so let's go do it. They agree that they're going to break into the house.
Ludicrous.
Which is a funny little moment.
Yes.
They do, and then they see Effie, they see this old nursemaid, and they see this
Lucy.
Little girl. Yeah. Lucy. And the thing that I like best about this story is that Watson is the person in this situation who this is how I interpret it anyway. Mm-hmm. He figures out what's going on first before either the husband or Holmes. Mm-hmm. Because they burst into the room, they see Lucy, and this is what Watson says. He says, I burst out laughing out of sympathy with her merriment, but Grant Monroe stood staring with his hands clutched at his throat. So the little girl sees them and laughs, and Watson sort of laughs with her. But I'm reading that as him sort of going like,
Oh, yeah.
I'm getting what's going on here. Mm-hmm. It is nowhere near as sinister as everyone seems to think it is.
Yeah, I think that totally makes sense. And it's a very nice little moment as well. It's a nice little joyful moment.
Yeah, I think it's sweet. Watson is like cracking this six-year-old girl up. As he should.
Yeah. Good on Watson. So Watson writes that... After Effie concludes her story and explains the narrative of events to her husband, Watson writes, quote, it was a long 10 minutes before Grant Monroe broke the silence, and when his answer came, it was one of which I love to think. He lifted the little child, kissed her, and then, still carrying her, he held his other hand out to his wife and turned towards the door. So Watson says very nicely that he likes to think about this little moment. It's very sweet.
Yeah, that's very heartwarming. Mm-hmm. I love that. I feel like Watson's sort of point of view and perspective on people wins out.
Yeah.
In not that I think he has a theory about what's going on, but Holmes has this very... dark and sort of troubled theory about what's happening. Mm-hmm. And his mind immediately goes to blackmail
right.
and leprosy and stuff.
That's a really good point that Watson
sort of gets to be delighted
worldview
by how happy things
end. Is confirmed in this story. Where people are kind of good. And it works out that people are good.
Yeah, it has sort of an optimistic tinge on how people choose to behave by the end. Which probably makes him feel, hey.
And I really do think that goes back to why Watson wrote this story. Like, I think he just wanted to write about a nice little lovely thing that happened at the conclusion of one of the cases.
And then, of course, the story wraps up with a desperately funny little moment. And they get all the way back to Baker Street.
Well, first, what happens before they get over to Baker Street is Holmes plucks at Watson's sleeve. To say that he doesn't think they need to be in Norbury anymore. But I like that Watson takes the time to say, like, oh, my friend plucked at my sleeve. I thought it was very cute.
Yeah. That is
cute. Sorry, go ahead.
And I like that sort of, like, silent communication, too. But they get all the way back, and then Holmes sort of like leans down, and what he says is, he says, "Watson," said he, it should ever strike you that I am getting a little overconfident in my powers, or giving less pains to a case than it deserves, kindly whisper Norbury in my ear, and I shall be infinitely obliged to you.
It's a very nice
that's how it ends.
Little
end. Really funny.
I think that's interesting,
like, please tell me when I'm being a jackass.
Yeah, I love that. And I love that that's the relationship where Watson has a code to be like, hey, Holmes, stop it.
Tone it down. Norbury.
The other thing that I was thinking about as you were reading that, in light of your comments about Holmes being a little bit misogynistic and how that leads him to believe that Effie has left her first husband because he was sick, is that in, I would say, all of the cases that we've seen so far where Holmes' misogyny shines through, is he's always being taken down a peg. You know, like Scandal in Bohemia, Second Stain.
Yeah.
He's always being shown, no, actually, women are more complex and not evil in the way that you're
expecting. Yeah, Effie's complex, for sure.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I do think that there is a bit of a trend in these cases where we see him sort of get his ego trumped, and cases where there are women who are heavily involved that he makes assumptions about that are not true.
Right. Like, it doesn't pay for Holmes to fit all women into a sort of a archetype like he tries to, because usually the characters in Conan Doyle's story is a little bit more nuanced than that, and their stories are more complicated.
You think he would learn his lesson.
And so there's not an easy answer. You think
not
he would.
Yet.
Not yet. Well, yeah. Irene Adler did a little bit.
Yeah.
But it can't just all be one and done, I suppose.
Well, all he learned is that there's one really impressive woman out there, and now he's going to learn that, you know, there are more than
there's
one.
A couple.
Perhaps.
Right. Mm. Can't wait for Kitty Winner to show up.
Oh, I know. The best, arguably.
The best. Okay. Is there anything else about this story that we have not discussed? It's, again, a very short, little, just tight package.
Yeah, so there's one other little moment, which I copied and pasted in my notes, and you also did in yours. And it's something, it's a little exchange between Monroe and Holmes, when Monroe is asking Holmes to take the case and why he wants to hire him. And what he says, what Monroe says is, I want your opinion as a judicious man, as a man of the world. I want to know what I ought to do next. I hope to God you're able to tell me. So that's interesting because he's not going like, I need your investigative powers. He wants sort of like his moral perspective, which I think we go on to say is not all that useful.
Right. Yeah, if this episode has demonstrated anything, it's that Holmes's moral compass is not always
like
due north.
You're asking the wrong one of the duo for that advice, in my
opinion. It is really interesting, though, because sometimes this is what clients want from Holmes, and it made me think about the Blue Carbuncle, in which Holmes acts as judge and jury. People come to him not only to solve mysteries, but also to receive advice. Which is interesting, because that is not typically within the role of a consulting detective. And then Holmes, in response to Monroe, says, quote, I was about to say that my friend and I have listened to many strange secrets in this room, and that we have had the good fortune to bring peace to many troubled souls. I trust we may do as much for you.
I like
Which
that.
Is a really nice little sentiment. Although, I don't know. I mean, I think the way that Holmes is able to bring peace to troubled souls is through the solving of a mystery, and not necessarily as a advice giver or a counselor. But I also think it's compelling that Holmes invokes Watson explicitly within this context, where he says, my friend and I have listened to many strange stories, and that we have been able to do this. Because I really don't think Holmes could do this without Watson.
That's a really good point. If you think of what I imagine were some of the cases that he solved before Watson got involved or got really involved, I think they probably, again, I'm extrapolating a lot here, but I would imagine that they are more on one end than the other. More just like pure deduction and facts and putting logic together that other people can't, and not this sort of thing. And because Watson has been involved, it seems like he's getting a little bit of a reputation as someone who is able to not only solve mysteries, but, like, put people's worries to rest, which sometimes those things go together, but not always. In this case, very much, it's one and not the other.
It makes me, again, think of, I know we mentioned this in Blue Carbuncle, but it makes me think of The Adventure of the Abbey Grange, which I'm really looking forward to. That's because I think the implications of Holmes and Watson's partnership and who acts as judge and who acts as jury and who is representative of the, you know, moral, upstanding British man, it becomes more clear in that story and how Holmes himself conceives of his position within that partnership.
And we're seeing, I think, sort of their ideological divide in this story, even if it's not explicitly said, just the way that they're responding to these fairly innocuous events.
Right.
Their world tells us something about who they are as people and where that's going to go.
Mm-hmm. Last thing I'll say is shout out to Atlanta. Cool little nod.
Yeah.
We don't often get non-Western aspects of the U.S.
True.
Or not as often, I guess. We've seen Florida, we've seen Pennsylvania, we've seen several stories that invoke the West.
Yeah, but they were very unspecific in terms of where they were taking place. This one's a very specific location. I'm not guessing about what mysterious, maybe coal mining valley the story is taking place, and it was definitely in Atlanta.
Yeah. I like the little shout out to some specificity in the U.S. Too.
He looked at a map today.
Congratulations, good work, Conan Doyle.
He looked at a map and he was only sort of racist. Okay, that's all I got.
Great.
That's all I have to say about this.
That's all I got, too. Did you find any adaptations?
I don't have a ton to say about this because the story is really not, it hasn't been adapted very much. It's featured in the big radio adaptations where they pretty much do every story.
Mm-hmm.
So
Clive
you can
Barrison.
Find, yeah. You can find radio versions of it. Granada didn't do it. And there are very, very few TV and film adaptations out there. The most well-known one seems to be a silent film from the 20s. So it's not a story that people are picking up and adapting on its face. I think you see little, like, bits of, like, the thread about Holmes being a boxer, and sometimes you see this thing about him having, like, Watson having a word that indicates, like, hey,
Norbury. I think Lindsay Faye in one of her stories references Norbury.
Which, that's a really great moment, so that makes sense that that works its way into pastiches and other references, but in terms of, like, people adapting The Yellow Face, like, it's very few and far between. It's sort of out of character for the rest
of
the
canon.
It's not
a mystery.
No.
I mean, there's no crime solving happening.
No. It would be, like, 5 minutes.
Right. Yes, I can imagine an adaptation that maybe in the vein of Soviet Holmes combines The Yellow Face with other stories, but
yeah,
I
true.
Do see how it would be difficult to sustain it on its own.
What about read-alikes? I think there are lots of different threads that we can pull on in terms
I
of things
so
that are
many.
Similar.
Right. I mostly focused on Black British writers.
Nice.
And just race relations, particularly when it comes to mixed race relationships.
Yeah.
And there's really obviously so much out there, and I encourage people to dig into that. A couple things immediately came to mind. Probably the first one that came to mind was a book that was later adapted into a very famous movie called To Sir With Love by E.R. Braithwaite. This is a Sidney Poitier movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
This is about a Black school teacher who falls in love with a white woman and is just sort of dealing with the fact of being a Black man who is teaching a bunch of white kids in a British school. A very famous movie as well. Zadie Smith and her entire oeuvre came to mind. Mm-hmm. So really, I would just encourage people to read Zadie Smith generally. She's a great, really great author. Swing Time, one of her more recent novels came to mind, so that might be something to check out. The other book that I would like to recommend is called The Lost Child by Carol Phillips.
Mm, I don't know what this
who
is.
I believe is a Caribbean writer, British Caribbean writer, and The Lost Child is a, I'm going to say, reinvention of Wuthering Heights, but also at the same time, it fills in the gaps of Heathcliff's life that we don't know about. So it moves between set in the late 18th century, as Wuthering Heights is, and fills in all the stuff that we don't know about Heathcliff. So his childhood, figuring him as the child of a enslaved woman.
Mm-hmm.
Which I could go on for a very long time, but very much tracks with the fact that Heathcliff was found in Liverpool, which was a major slave trade right. port. And then it also moves into a more modern story in which there is a mixed-race relationship, sort of mirroring Heathcliff and Kathy mm-hmm. in that way.
Wow. That sounds
so
fascinating.
So it's a really fascinating novel. If you've read Wuthering Heights, I highly recommend reading The Lost Child. It might be a little bit difficult to follow if you aren't familiar with Wuthering Heights. There are yeah. moments when it goes into narrative about Emily Bronte as well. It's just a really fascinating novel. Finally, my last recommendation is the 2016 movie Loving, which, yeah. as we referenced, is mm-hmm. about the Loving case mm-hmm. that finally overturned the criminalization of mixed-race marriages.
So I have one film recommendation.
Okay, great.
Because it's not a movie I've seen yet, but it's been on my mind, and I'm looking forward to it. It's Passing is the movie.
Yes, I thought about that as well.
Which came out in 2021, so it's fairly
yeah,
recent.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see this.
Starring Tessa Thompson and mm-hmm. Ruth Negga.
Yes.
Directed by Rebecca Hall. And it's based mm-hmm. on a book. And it's really interesting, an interesting project. It's about two mixed race women, one of whom passes as white, one of whom doesn't. And their relationship and race in this time period. It's shot all in black and white. I think it's doing some really interesting things. And it Rebecca Hall really specifically wanted to take on this project because it mirrors her family history, where she kind of uncovered that she has black ancestry in her history but looks very white, and it became this passion project for her. I love her so much.
Yeah, she's great.
And I love both of the actors in it. I think it also has mm-hmm. Andre Holland in it, who I also love. So I haven't seen it yet, but I've heard only good things, and it's being very well reviewed. And mm-hmm. I think in terms of thinking about these themes of identity and maybe sort of like reclaiming these stories about mixed race black women, that might be nice to watch too.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic
take a better spin on these things.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think our general point here is to read black authors and yeah. to watch movies made by black creators.
Yep. True.
Go forth. There is so much out there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think
really
you have
hard to narrow it down.
A really nice starting list, but I feel like you could just keep going forever. Join us in 2 weeks for our narration of The Adventure of the Greek Interpreter.
And a special thanks to our narrator, Alex Gallegos.
You can send your thoughts to howeverimprobablepod@gmail.com or reach us on Twitter @improbablepod. Our website, howeverimprobablepodcast.com, has got transcripts, the research behind the episode, and suggestions for further reading. If you enjoyed the show and can spare a moment, please rate and review.
However Improbable is created by Marissa Mercurio and Sarah Culp, with apologies to Arthur Conan Doyle. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, dear listeners, believe us to be very sincerely yours.
That one can't always say convincingly.
I mean,
I don't think he deserves it today.
No, me neither.
Okay.